billion-dollar health ideas.
I'm the most brutal of them.
I'm going to show you how good it has ever been.
I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
Round one, fight.
There are kind of two kinds of technological transformation I see happening in healthcare and life sciences. One is linear incremental progress. And that's kind of what we've had, you know, for a long time over the years. And we get better each year. You post better quality ratings, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's nonlinear, right? Stuff like the implementation of software for medical records, for example, various kind of approaches to programming biology, right? I'm spending a lot of time in generative AI. There's a lot of hype around it. It's a technology that's actually been around for a long time. At Bessemer, we made our first investment in generative AI in 2018 into a company called Subtle Medical that was using generative AI for image denoising. And then we made an investment actually in 2019 into a company called Abridge that is using, and at the time in 2019, was using generative methods to transcribe conversations between physicians and patients, as well as physicians and other physicians. We are now at a point with GPT, whether it's 3, 3.5, soon to be 4, that the performance of these foundation models, which are these large models that are adept at many different kinds of tasks, is sufficiently interesting to produce results that might be valuable at scale. So spending a lot of time thinking particularly about how generative AI first is going to transform the healthcare back office, right? All the gutsy stuff that maybe as a physician, you know, you didn't get out of bed in the morning to do, or you didn't go through training to do, particularly in the revenue cycle management space. If I were to think about it, in the life sciences, I'm spending a lot of time in computational biology, thinking about how these same generative methods married with efficiencies in scientific methodology, sequencing, et cetera, can help us build larger, more efficient, and more successful drug development organizations with the end goal, of course, on making medicines that work for patients. The wonkiest thesis I have right now that I will share, and I don't even know if it's that wonky, is in biosecurity. So some quick context is why I mentioned this area. My dad worked at the EPA for 30 years. He was the director of emergency response, which is one of the worst jobs in the world, frankly, because you basically get a phone call every time there is a wildfire, you know, a hurricane, flooding, any sort of toxin in the water. But what I noticed in the last few years of his career, notably with COVID, the kinds of things he was responding to, you know, increasingly became of biochemical origin, broadly, right? You marry that with kind of what we saw happen during the pandemic, and then you marry that with the fact that in an afternoon, using off-the-shelf computational methods, researchers have been able to design highly toxic molecules in silico that could, you know, in theory, easily be shipped to places and, you know, manufactured. I think this is going to be a very important area over the next few years. The questions that loom are, what are the business models for the technology companies, both software as well as molecular technologies, that are going to kind of contribute to the biosecurity discourse? And what kinds of teams and what kinds of skill sets are going to be required to develop these companies? I would imagine it's going to require folks with deep computational experience, deep biochemical and scientific experience, you know, security experience broadly, and an understanding of the way that contracting works in the government, right? We're specifically talking about defense contracting and being able to tap into some of those RFPs, some of those budgets, and some of those deployment cycles.
Right. So I understood very little of that last point. So maybe you could do an explain like on five business or how what would this look like? Like, I don't
for biosecurity.
It.
Yeah. So if you're a synthetic biologist today and you're using computational methods to develop new molecules, how do you know that what you're developing isn't potentially toxic, right? Like, do you have access to every screening library that's, you know, produced, whether it's by, you know, the federal government, state governments, international governing bodies, to say, hey, the sequences or the nucleic acids that you're thinking of producing or putting together could actually cause harm to society in this way? It's like, do we have appropriate guardrails in the synthetic biology space today to prevent catastrophic biochemical events from happening at scale? My gut and my research suggests that no, we don't have that. I don't mean to be alarmist in any way, but my sense is that, again, as we saw with software, it's not a big mental leap. As things became digital and software proliferated in a lot of industries, we needed to secure that information that had become digital across those industries. And the cybersecurity sector blossomed, right, as those pieces of information not only came online, but became interconnected. We have a very similar trend happening now as biology and chemistry is increasingly programmable and digital, right? And we're going to need infrastructure to make sure that that information is both kept safe and also not used for downstream harm. I think these technologies are very early. This is a very early thesis in general, but I would imagine that the category itself will produce tens of billions of dollars, if not more, if not hundreds of billions of dollars of value to society over the next 10 years.